From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Hollywood guilds are spreading awards love wider than the upcoming Oscars. Then Lorena Bobbitt was charged with maliciously wounding her husband in 1993 and became the butt of many jokes. But a new Amazon documentary series reconsiders her story through the lens of domestic violence.
Kind of comes down to just the way domestic violence was dealt with in the late 80s and early 90s. There was no real protocol in place.
And how subway cars, clothing steamers, elephants, and lions helped build the soundscape of the movie First Man. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Almost everyone in Hollywood and a whole lot of people who care about movies are currently obsessing about the Academy Awards, which happens this coming Sunday. But the awards season does not begin and end with the Oscars. It's also the time of year when the biggest unions hand out their top prizes in town, and sometimes those trophies say as much about the film business, if not more, than the Academy Awards. This past weekend, the Writers Guild of America announced its winners for the best screenplays of the last year, and WGA voters awarded Best Original Screenplay to a movie that wasn't even nominated for an Oscar, Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. Claudia Puig is the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association, and she joined me in studio today to discuss the WGA prizes and other trophies handed out by Hollywood's big guilds. We started by talking about Eighth Grade.
It's such a terrific script, and it was such an oversight that it wasn't nominated, that, and many of us have been upset about it. So it was really great to see this get the love it deserves. And it doesn't surprise me that it's the writers, because the writers, A, are used to being overlooked. So
no, really?
Yeah. So, of course, they would try to correct that wrong. And I also think there's, you know, comedies have always kind of gotten short shrift. And it's not really a comedy per se, but it has comic elements. And then films that are about tweens and teens are kind of overlooked. I mean, I was thinking about like the movie The Hate U Give, which was at least as good as Bohemian Rhapsody or Green Book or some of the others that did get nominated for Best Picture, completely overlooked because it has the YA taint. And I think that in this case, right, you know, you hear the title Eighth Grade and you just assume that maybe she was improvising. You don't realize how tightly scripted it was by Bo Burnham.
We talked with Bo Burnham about his lead actress, Elsie Fisher, about a year ago when the film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival.
So there was a long rehearsal process, which was mostly for the script, mostly just to make sure that it sounded right. And if things didn't sound right, it was always the script's fault. What I was trying to capture was what she was in many ways. So to have the real thing there, it's, just completely subjugate myself to it.
I love this film. And the movie that won the adapted screenplay at the Writers Guild is also a movie that I think we both liked a lot. It is nominated for an Academy Award, and that is Can You Ever Forgive Me? The screenplay was by Nicole Holofcener and Jeff Whitty.
I hear they got Tom Clancy $3 million to write some more red-baiting propaganda.
Lee, my morning has been long enough already.
He's a fraud.
What's your point?
He's drinking sherry at your party. No self-respecting writer would drink sherry.
Oh, Lord.
I need you to get me a book advance on my Fanny Bryce book. I need you to get $10,000. I'm months behind in my rent. My cat is sick. And isn't this the exact reason that I have an agent?
I can't get you an advance like that, Lee. I just can't.
Give me one reason.
Directed by a woman, Mariel Heller. Co-written by a woman, Nicole Holofcener, and stars a woman of a certain age, Melissa McCarthy, who isn't the beauty pageant attractive character we're used to seeing. So in many ways, a real outlier when it comes to movies.
Yeah, Nicole Holofcener is so worthy. She's done such great films. And I think that it was such a clever, pithy script. Both of them are definitely the best screenplays. So I'm really happy to see these particular Writers Guild awards.
So I would say the Writers Guild, to my mind, is actually kind of ahead of the curve in some ways. And then you look at another big Hollywood guild, the Screen Actors Guild, not so much. The Screen Actors Guild has an award for Best Ensemble, which is essentially its Best Picture award. Eighth Grade wasn't nominated. Roma wasn't nominated. I mean, they gave their best Ensemble Award to Black Panther feels like it's kind of conservative and safe in terms of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, I was happy to see Black Panther get an award because I think it's worthy of one. But I feel like the Directors Guild and the Writers Guild are a little bit more cutting edge. I mean, the Directors Guild did give Best First Feature to Bo Burnham, and it gave Best Director to Alfonso Cuarón. So I think that they're, you know, kind of on the right track. But I think you're right about the Screen Actors Guild. It is sort of shocking that they wouldn't have nominated those films that you mentioned. And yet they're the largest block. They always say right. The largest block of the Academy.
And now let's talk about the Producers Guild of America, because they give their Best Picture award to Green Book, which I think is a legitimate contender for Best Picture, but you're shaking your head. You're not a fan.
Not a fan. I think this is, as many people, someone said before me, but I'll say it again. This is the best movie in 1965. It feels so retro. It feels tone deaf in the era that we're living in now with the rampant racism that we have to make a movie that has, you know, that's about racism that feels cute and cuddly just doesn't work for me at all.
My defense, and I like the film, is I'd rather have that movie than not. And even if it has flaws, yes, I see the criticism, but I also am glad that this is a film that people can talk about. The other thing that I thought was interesting is the American Society of Cinematographers gave its award for Best Cinematography not to Alfonso Cuarón for Roma, but to Lucas Zal for shooting Cold War.
Yes, that was really interesting because I think it's widely accepted that what Alfonso Cuarón did was amazing. And, you know, he didn't use his usual cinematographer, Emmanuel Chivo Lubezki. However, the fact that it was his first time, I mean, if you're a hardcore cinematographer, maybe you want to give it to somebody who's done, you know, lots of good work rather than somebody who did an amazing job, but, you know, isn't really a cinematographer.
So obviously everybody wants to be nominated for and win an Academy Award, but isn't it important for these filmmakers to receive recognition from their peers? Do those guilds mean something to the artists themselves, do you think?
I think they mean a lot to the artists because it is your peers, you know, giving you this award. And it's also, it means a lot, I think, in terms of your career. You know, the doors will be not just opened, but, you know, like held open with, you know, red carpets out because of it. So I think it's possibly even more important than Academy Award. The Academy Award may be important to, you know, lay people, to moviegoers. But I think when it comes to the industry, the Guild Awards are really important.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that if you haven't seen Eighth Grade and you haven't seen Can You Ever Forgive Me, these Writers Guild Awards are important reminders that you need to go out and see them. Claudia Puig is the president of the LA Film Critics Association. She's also a frequent guest on Film Week with Larry Mantle. Claudia, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a new documentary series about Lorena Bobbitt looks at the jokes made at her expense and the people who missed the real story of domestic violence.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. A word of warning to listeners with young children in the audience. In this segment, we'll be talking about the documentary series Lorena, and our conversation includes discussions of violent adult material. A little more than 25 years ago, Lorena Bobbitt was accused of malicious wounding.
The cut heard round the world comes to court at last.
The sensational trial is attracting quite a bit of media attention.
There are about 15 to 20 satellite trucks, about 200 reporters.
This time, Court TV is bringing the proceedings into millions of homes.
Lorena Bobbitt goes on trial today on charges of malicious wounding. She's facing a 20-year sentence in prison, a maximum, if she is
Bobbitt had cut off her husband's penis in 1993 with a kitchen knife and thrown it out the car window, The authorities found the detached penis and doctors were able to reattach it, and the whole story went as viral as possible in the pre-internet era. There was a circus atmosphere during her trial, and Lorena became the butt of many cruel jokes. The Amazon documentary series Lorena, produced by Jordan Peele and directed by my guest, Joshua Roffe, examines what was lost in the media's reporting. There's ample use of archival footage in the series, as well as modern interviews both with Lorena and her now ex-husband, John Wayne Bobbitt. We'll start with the fact that Lorena Bobbitt was an immigrant from Ecuador and totally dependent on her husband when they got married.
Lorena came here at age 18 in search of the American dream. Thought she found it when she met this handsome, charming Marine named John Wayne Bobbitt. And they dated for about 10 months. She was a virgin. They had a chaperone on every date. It was this very pure courting period that was beyond old-fashioned. Then they got married. And according to Lorena, a few weeks into the marriage, they were driving home one night. He was drunk, driving erratically, and she was screaming and begging for him to stop and slow down. And then he punched her in the chest. And according to Lorena, this then essentially began the next 4 years of beatings, rape on a regular basis.
And it's not just according to Lorena, because what you do in your series is you step back not only from her marriage to John Wayne Bobbitt, but other women who encountered John Wayne Bobbitt over the years. And many of them, including a couple of his former wives, tell almost identical stories.
That's very true. When we were making this, we kept finding more victims. And in episode 4, one of those victims who's never spoken publicly will speak and tell a story that is as harrowing as anything you'll ever hear. It was really terrifying to find that all the stories that we found, all the people that we spoke to, they essentially had experienced the same specific details that Lorena had in terms of the abuse, whether it was the way the hands were held, the way they would be sexually assaulted, and so on and so forth.
The threats he would make if they said anything or tried to do anything.
Absolutely. Letting them know that they could never escape him. This is a person who, according to multiple courts of law, is a serial abuser.
A lot of people know what happened between Lorena Bobbitt and John Wayne Bobbitt, and that is that she cut off his penis and it was surgically reattached. But what your documentary series is about is something different. So when you started work on this documentary, what were your assumptions? How did they mirror what maybe the public's assumptions were? And how did you decide that there was a much bigger story that you wanted to tell? And how did that story start to fall into place?
I mean, I guess everybody remembers the cutoff penis. They don't remember the fact that she was horrifically abused. So that was sort of ground zero for us. But as we got deeper into making it, and all of a sudden, all these pieces were so obviously in place, and those pieces would essentially set her up for disaster. Anita Hill, William Kennedy Smith rape trial, the Tailhook scandal, these massive landmark moments in, you know, very recent American history where women were violated and they either weren't believed or they were vilified or they even went through some sort of judicial process and came up short. That was in the years leading up to Lorena's story hitting. And so when 1993 came around, she was up against something that was insurmountable.
Her husband actually knows that he has multiple cards to play against her, and one of them is the threat of deportation, mm-hmm. which he holds against her. Let's hear what she has to say about her own life and coming to the United States.
Just because this guy here, this abusive husband, was shattering my American dream, I wouldn't let that happen. So I was just trying to fight it.
So when this incident happens, Lorena Bobbitt quickly, I think, realizes that she is in way over her head. What is she up against in terms of the institutions, in terms of the way that people in law enforcement are talking about her case?
You know, it kind of comes down to just the way domestic violence was dealt with in the late 80s and early 90s. And we start to go into that, especially in episode 4, where one of the cops who was part of the search for the penis that night, he tells us, the viewer, essentially what it was like for a police officer to show up to a domestic violence 911 call. And there was no real protocol in place. Tell someone to go for a walk, walk the husband around the block, let him cool off, right? And then the cops would leave. And then whoever was the victim in this case is locked right back in that house with the person who's been abusing them. And so for Lorena, no matter where she looked, there really was no help.
I think one of the things that is as disturbing as her testimony is that the way that people, and I'm thinking not just in the news media, but comedians, misogynistic comedians like Andrew Dice Clay and Howard Stern talked about her in the most degrading ways, even when she goes on Steve Harvey's talk show. All he can do is make jokes.
I will never forget, there was a moment, and it's in episode three, and episode three is edited by an editor who is nothing short of a genius. Her name's Azine Samari. And Azine called me into the cutting room to show me a piece that she had just put together. And it was during Lorena's trial when John Wayne had called into the Howard Stern show. And this is following the graphic details of the rapes, of the beatings being broadcast for all to see and hear. And Howard Stern's response was, he said he doesn't believe her. He attacked her physical appearance in really ways that are too despicable to even repeat.
Well, I'll repeat some of them. He said that she had acne and therefore that she couldn't have been raped.
There you go. Yes. I just don't understand how he could hear the things that she had to say and then choose to take that stance. It transcends whatever your shtick is, you know?
We're talking with Joshua Roffe about his documentary series, Lorena. You speak to Lorena Bobbitt and you speak to John Wayne Bobbitt. And I can imagine that both had issues about being on tape. Tell me what your pitch was to them and why it was important that they be included on camera.
My pitch to Lorena was essentially just sharing the previous films that I'd made over the last 10 years with her. I asked her to watch the films so she can get an idea of, you know, the level of empathy and sensitivity that I would attempt to bring to the telling of her story. We had a couple of conversations, and she very generously was game and was on board very, very quickly. With John Wayne, anybody with a camera can show up and get an interview with John Wayne. And my pitch to him was, it was very simple. I'm telling this story, and I'm interested in what everybody's version of the truth is. And he also was pretty quick to say yes.
And he didn't ask to be paid?
If you have a person who was part of a scandal, their interview is their form of currency, absolutely.
Was she paid as well?
Yes, she was.
Do you feel like you should have disclosed that? I'm wondering.
I don't think it really changes what you get from somebody. I really don't. I think that if you want to basically take a chunk of somebody's life for, frankly, an exclusive period of time, there's nothing wrong with them being compensated.
When the assault happens, there are a lot of people, and I won't say they come to Lorena's aid, but they offer their services to Lorena. Let's hear a little bit from Alan Hogan.
The attorneys called me up and they said, the trial is being set for December 23rd. I said, nobody's going to watch this. At Christmas time, you're going to be kidding me. Move it into January. If you look at Nielsen ratings, viewership goes way down because people are out shopping and they're with their families and all that. So we had to move Lorena's trial into January.
It feels like the people who glom onto her do not have her interests at heart.
She was doomed. She was in this horribly abusive marriage. And then the people who were close to her, who should have been shielding her and protecting her when this media firestorm gets set off, they were looking for ways to monetize it.
What did you take away about the media's obsession with Lorena, but not about what she was saying? And they're advocates for women's rights and for sexual assault victims who say everybody kept missing the story that Lorena was trying to tell. They were focused on the severed penis, not about marital rape.
I mean, this story was the original clickbait. And the headline that everybody would click on is about a cut-off penis. I think it really is that simple. They're interested in, you know, ratings and advertising, buys for their programs. And how do you get that? You get that with clickbait. And that's what this story was.
Joshua Roffe is the director and executive producer of Lorena. Joshua, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The documentary series Lorena is available now on Amazon Prime Video. Coming up on The Frame, the Oscar-nominated sound editors of the Neil Armstrong movie, First Man.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Oh my God, it's
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Wanna know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We've seen it happen on TV. Maybe we've read books about the experience, but most of us will never know what it actually feels like to break through the Earth's atmosphere and travel into space. For the sound editors of First Man, that's the Neil Armstrong movie directed by Damien Chazelle, their task was to put the audience as close to what that experience may have felt like as possible.
My name is Mildred Iatru Morgan, and I'm the supervising sound editor on First Man.
Jiminy 8, this is Houston Capcom. Please stand by to copy.
I got my room like this. Look at all these papers.
My name is Eileen Lee. I'm the sound designer, supervising sound editor, and re-recording mixer on First Man.
And now look at all the crayons.
This film is mostly a quiet, personal, intimate film. It almost felt like you're watching someone's 16mm home movie. And so to kind of match what we see, you know, the grainy texture, we needed to give it sort of like an unpolished feel.
Rick? Okay, out here now.
Normally when we edit dialogue on a film, our mission is to clean it up as much as possible to get rid of any artifacts so that you just hear the dialogue. In this case, Damien made it very clear that he wanted the Earth scenes, the scenes on Earth, the intimate scenes amongst the family, the scenes that, you know, with the astronauts working on Earth, he wanted it to sound like a documentary.
I got one. Who did what?
Damien liked to say that this movie covers the moon and the kitchen sink. And the kitchen sink are all those scenes where the family's at home and they're arguing and the kids are playing and running around and making a mess, in contrast with the world of NASA.
T-minus 1 minute and counting on the Atlas Agena launch.
The Gemini 8 mission is actually Neil Armstrong's first trip to space. And that mission is really important to the Apollo mission. So a lot was like hanging on Neil Armstrong's shoulders. So how Damien wanted to start the Gemini 8 mission was his long walk to be seated into the Gemini 8 capsule and being strapped in. Damien had always wanted this sound of like this slow cycling feeling of tension, this slow boiling tension that's, you know, building up. And we just took that inspiration and used sounds that we could see and hear in that sequence, such as like, you know, steam releases or actually dry cleaner steam. We would like Doppler it or pitch manipulate it so it sounds like this. It's on this cycling rhythmic beat. And as it goes along, we introduce low rhythmic thumps that almost sound like a heartbeat that's metallic, which are actually like subway clunks and thumps. So all of these were built up tension and increasingly built up to a point where, like, no, the door shuts. This door are really ancient and heavy. It's like you've been trapped and locked in and you have nowhere else to go. and then to put you back into Neil's perspective. You only hear Neil's breathing. During the Gemini launch, because we are always inside the cockpit with the astronauts, never really showing what's happening outside, the sound has to carry a lot of the energy and to keep building in intensity. So we started off the sequence with real rocket launch sounds. To add on to that, to help with the anger and fury of the machine that is pushing them up to space, we started coming up with like using different animal vocals like elephants, lions. Manipulate that pitch and so that they just sound like, you know, they're just screaming and roaring out of these turbines. To have this visceral sense of anxiety felt by the characters.
For me, my biggest challenge on First Man was dealing with Neil Armstrong's famous words on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Early on in the editing process, Tom Cross, the picture editor, sent me Ryan Gosling's performance of those words, and which were very similar to what Neil Armstrong said. But Tom said to me, can you get it even closer? Can you get it to the point where it sounds like it could be Neil Armstrong? So I spent a lot of time on that, making sure the rhythm was exactly the same.
I'm going to step off the limb now.
Stealing the static from the original and blending it in. And then at the very end, when I sort of had it all kind of close to where I wanted it, I used a plug-in to manipulate the pitch of some of Ryan Gosling's a couple of words and a couple even syllables so that it sounded as close as I could possibly get it.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Subsequently, when we show the film, I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you actually used Neil Armstrong there. And I was like, no, we didn't. That's Ryan Gosling. So that's always incredibly satisfying when I hear that from people.
Mildred Iacho-Morgan and Eileen Lee are the Oscar-nominated sound editors of First Man. That piece was put together by Frame producer Monica Bushman. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year. Now playing.